24 and verses 5 to 21. We have found this man to be a troublemaker, stirring up riots among the Jews all over the world. He is a ringleader of the Nazarene sect and even tried to desecrate the temple, so we seized him. By examining him yourself, you will be able to learn the truth about all these charges we are bringing against him. The Jews joined in this accusation, asserting that these things were true. When the governor motioned for him to speak, Paul replied, "I know that for a number of years you have been a judge over this nation, so I gladly make my defense. You can easily verify that no more than 12 days ago I went up to Jerusalem to worship. My accusers did not find me arguing with anyone in the temple or stirring up a crowd in the synagogues or anywhere else in the city. And they cannot prove to you the charges they are now making against me. However, I admit that I worship the God of our fathers as a follower of the way, which they call a sect. I believe everything that agrees with the law and that is written in the prophets, and I have the same hope in God as these men, that there will be a resurrection of both the righteous and the wicked. So I strive always to keep my conscience clear before God and man. After an absence of several years, I came to Jerusalem to bring my people gifts for the poor and to present offerings. I was ceremonially clean when they found me in the temple courts doing this. There was no crowd with me, nor was I involved in any disturbance. But there are some Jews from the province of Asia who ought to be here before you and bring charges if they have anything against me. Or these who are here should state what crime they find in me when I stood before the Sanhedrin. Unless it was this one thing I shouted as I stood in their presence. It is concerning the resurrection of the dead that I am on trial before you today." Amen.
Adventures of Paul. Last week we saw that Paul had enemies all around, and that as soon as he escaped from one danger, he found himself in another. The Jerusalem crowd wanted to rid the earth of him. The commander of the Roman soldiers wanted to have him flogged. The Sanhedrin, as a court of law, was supposed to try him, but was full of men who hated him and wanted him dead. From one danger to another, and another. At the end of last week's story, we found that the Roman commander had rescued Paul from the violent scenes happening in the Sanhedrin and had taken him into the barracks. And so Paul was back in a Roman prison cell and was somewhat downhearted. But that night, he had a vision of Jesus, who said to him, "Take courage, cheer up. You've been a good witness for me here in Jerusalem. Now you're going to be a witness for me in Rome." Brilliant. Paul had had this conviction and desire to go to Rome, and here was Jesus saying that that was going to happen. In spite of everything, God was still in control. But if Paul was packing his metaphorical bags and in his mind getting ready for the journey to Rome, he was in for a shock, because it was going to be a long time before he got there. The commander of the Roman soldiers may have rescued Paul from the middle of the Sanhedrin, but that didn't mean that the Jews were going to let it be. The next day, more than 40 men formed a conspiracy, and they bound themselves with an oath that they would not eat or drink until they'd killed Paul. That's quite a lot of determination. They went to the chief priests and elders and told them about their oath, and they asked them to petition the commander to bring Paul back to the Sanhedrin on the pretext of wanting more accurate information about his case. Their plan was that they would kill him while he was on his way there. So how was Paul going to get out of this one? Well, it so happened that his nephew heard about the plot. He went to the barracks and told Paul, and Paul called one of the centurions and said, "Take this young man to the commander. He has something to tell him." How did Paul's nephew get to hear about this? I love the way that Tom Wright imagines it. It is extremely easy to suppose that with all those serious men making this solemn oath not to eat, well, they wouldn't turn up for dinner for a start. "Where's Dad?" "Hush, dear, he's doing God's work." "Oh, that's exciting. What does God want him to do?" "Hush, dear, he won't be eating until they've got rid of that troublemaker they caught in the temple." And a little boy tells another little boy down the street, and they hear of someone else who's in it as well. And soon all the little boys realize that there's something going on, and one of them just happens to be the nephew of the man whose name is on everyone's lips, and who will soon, they hope, be at the point of their knives. What an example of the providence of God. But Paul's life was obviously not safe in Jerusalem, and the commander couldn't take the risk that a Roman citizen in his care would be assassinated. Paul would be safer at Caesarea, under the responsibility of the governor of Judea himself. So the commander ordered 200 soldiers, 70 horsemen, and 200 spearmen to leave that night to take Paul to the Roman governor, Felix. What an incredible military force to protect one man. Paul had spent much of the past few years avoiding having much to do with any of the authorities, and now the full machinery of the Roman army was mustered to rescue him and take him to the governor. The commander also sent a letter to Governor Felix, which said, "When I was informed of the plot to be carried out against the man, I sent him to you at once. I also ordered his accusers to present to you their case against him." And he explained in the letter that Paul was accused of things to do with the Jewish law. But significantly, he said, there was no charge against him that deserved death or imprisonment. So Paul and the letter were duly delivered to Felix. And Felix, who one assumes would much rather have had nothing at all to do with this, ordered that Paul be kept under guard in the palace, saying that he would hear his case when his accusers arrived. His accusers arrived 5 days later. And of course, we wonder whether they had eaten or drunk in those past 5 days. If not, they would have been even more desperate to have Paul done away with. But I suspect they would have found a way out of their stupid vow and gone back to eating at some point over that period. They'd brought a lawyer with them to carry out the case for the prosecution. He was called Tertullus, and he was at the smarmy end of the spectrum of lawyers, beginning with obsequious flattery of Felix. Then came what Paul was actually charged with. We have found this man to be a troublemaker, stirring up riots among the Jews all over the world. He is a ringleader of the Nazarene sect and even tried to desecrate the temple. If true, that was potentially fairly serious. The accusation of being a troublemaker and stirring up riots was actually a threat to public order at a time when public order mattered rather a lot. And of course, there had actually been a riot in Jerusalem. That's why Paul had got picked up in the first place, although he'd done nothing to stir it up. And there was no question that Paul was a member of what is called the Nazarene sect. The only time we find this description being used for followers of Jesus of Nazareth. We've already heard Paul's defense, as George read to us. He denied arguing at the temple or stirring up the crowd. He admitted his belief in Jesus. "I worship the God of our fathers as a follower of the way," he said. He clarified what had happened at his hearing before the Sanhedrin. But he also spoke about how his beliefs corresponded to Judaism. He worshipped the same God as the people accusing him. He believed the scriptures, everything that agreed with the law and that was written in the prophets. He shared the Jewish hope of the resurrection. He pointed to his clear conscience and his mission to bring gifts of money for the poor Christians in Jerusalem. "They cannot prove to you the charges they are now making against me," he said. "It is because of the resurrection of the dead that I am on trial before you today." Well, Felix the governor was a really weak and indecisive man. He didn't want to condemn an obviously innocent man, but he didn't have the courage to upset the Jews by setting Paul free. And so, not knowing what to do, he simply adjourned the case. "When the commander comes," he said, "I'll decide your case then." He gave orders that Paul was to be kept in custody, but to be given some freedom and to be allowed to have his friends provide for him. There's no suggestion that the commander ever came or that Felix ever reached a decision on the case. 2 years went by with nothing happening, and then a new governor was appointed. But Felix didn't take the chance then to release Paul. Because he was currying favor with the Jews, he left him in prison. The man God had called to take the gospel to the Gentiles, the man Jesus said would be his witness in Rome, was stuck in a Roman prison. But during that time, God still used Paul as his witness. Because a few days after the trial, Felix and his wife Drusilla, who was a Jewess, sent for Paul and listened to him as he spoke about faith in Jesus. Felix didn't much like what Paul had to say, because Paul spoke about righteousness, self-control, and the judgment to come, and that really scared Felix. Drusilla was his third wife, and he'd married her when she was 16, when he'd persuaded her to leave her then husband. So this was all a bit uncomfortably personal. And yet, over the years in which Paul was kept in prison, because he was hoping that Paul would offer him a bribe for his freedom, Felix sent for him frequently and talked with him. And there is no doubt what Paul would have talked to him about. Paul's adventures are such a good story, but we all have our own story. And all our stories, Paul's story and our stories, are all about a relationship with Jesus and our walk with him. And so let's pause here for a moment and let's stay seated as we. So what might God be saying to us from this story? Well, firstly, we see the providence of God. God continued to protect Paul from the dangers that were around him. And mostly, it was the Romans that he used to do it. I wonder what Paul thought when he was surrounded by hundreds of Roman soldiers taking him out of Jerusalem. Was he struck by the irony of it? Surely he must have thought that God moves in mysterious ways. And then in prison in Caesarea, witnessing about Jesus to the Roman governor and his wife, could he ever have imagined that he would be doing that? What about your life? What you are doing? Is it what you would have expected or what you planned? The prophet Isaiah says, "For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, declares the Lord. As the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts higher than your thoughts." Don't we all often know that God's ways are not our ways? That if we were running the world, or even running our own lives, we would do it differently? Fortunately, we're not. Isaiah continues, "The word that goes out from my mouth will not return to me empty, but will accomplish what I desire and achieve the purpose for which I sent it." The providence of God, who accomplishes his desires in us and through us. The grace and mercy and care of God for us. His best purposes for us, even when we struggle to see them. He wants only the very best for us, and his love will bring that about. The providence of God. But secondly, we see something about waiting. Tom Wright says, "The 2 years Paul spent in custody in Caesarea must have been at one level pure torture for him. Like an eagle with its wings clipped, he could see the wider world out there, the sea coast and the harbour where he'd put in more than once were just a few minutes' walk from where he was confined but he couldn't reach them. What happened to his own sense of vocation about going to Rome? He had sent a letter to the church there, telling them he was on his way after a brief visit to Jerusalem. And now this. What had happened to Jesus' clear promise to him that he would get to Rome in the end? No answer came. What do we make of it when God does not move to our timetable, when we seem to be stuck, waiting for him to act? Sometimes I think that God seldom moves to our timetable, that we always seem to be waiting. But there's such a lot in the Bible about the people of God waiting. We read the great stories of what God did, and we're amazed by them and we rejoice in them. But what of the in-between times? The times when people cried out for God to move and nothing happened. The years of captivity in Egypt, the years of living under wicked kings, the years of captivity in Babylon, most of the story of God's people seems to be about waiting. What of the day between the crucifixion and the resurrection, Holy Saturday, the day the whole world waited, the day when it seemed as though all was lost and God's purposes had failed? I think we all have times of being there, of waiting for God to act and wondering if he will. But Holy Saturday shows us that even when we can't see what he is doing or how it will end, God is still at work, redeeming everything. I read recently that sometimes all we can do is kneel before him and wait. Paul was in danger and then on trial because he was a follower of Jesus. And across the world, many thousands of people are in that same position today. Thousands of very brave men and women are waiting in prison cells, waiting maybe for trial or waiting for possible execution as they insist on holding firm to their faith in Jesus. Their waiting is hard and courageous. As we trust him for our lives in the waiting times, we should also pray for them. Amen.